The following program is a PodcastOne.com production. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse, unscripted. Now, here's your host, John Horn.
I'm John Horn, and today on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, we're going to talk with Michael Emerson. You probably know him best from Lost. He's also on Arrow. He's on Mozart in the Jungle. He has a great story for actors who haven't yet made it. He failed when he came to New York. He almost gave it up. He came back, and he's very successful. So stick around. Michael Emerson on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Hey, humans. David Smalley here from the Dogma Debate Podcast right here on Podcast One, where we talk about all the things you're not supposed to discuss at work: religion, politics, abortion, racism, slavery.
And that's only when we open the Bible.
We discuss Islam, Islamophobia.
What does that even mean?
We chat with vegans, animal rights activists, and even visit factory farms to see it for ourselves. I invite people from multiple backgrounds to convert me into their worldview. But as long as they're okay with being respectfully challenged,
you better bring your evidence.
And I never lose sight of how both the left and the right are seeming to lose their minds. So basically, we're solving all the world's problems right here on Dogma Debate.
And you've been missing it.
Watch our 360 virtual reality videos on the Podcast One app and download Dogma Debate on iTunes, Stitcher, or PodcastOne.com.
Now back to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Michael Emerson, welcome to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Nice to be here. Thank you. I love the Geffen.
Well, that's very nice. And we love talking about theater. We love talking about film. We love talking about television. Something that we haven't yet talked about on this podcast that I'm a huge fan of, and I know you've done a little bit of yourself, is audiobooks. Tell me about your work recording books on tape, because it's how I pass the time in traffic, and I suspect I've listened to some of your books.
Well, I really enjoy the work, but I have to say it is some of the hardest acting work I have ever done. It's a real particular skill, I think. I'm not even saying I have it, because there's a bunch of guys out there whose names you don't even know who are just masters of it. But you're in a booth for a long time, and you just have to keep it going.
I was looking at some books that you've recorded, All the King's Men Unabridged by Robert Penn Warren, 20 yeah. hours and 57 minutes. It makes the Eugene O'Neill play look like a brief walk in the park.
And I was 50 hours in the booth to record it.
At least it pays incredibly well. Wait, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. But it's a wonderful experience if you love the written word, or if you love language. And I found at some points in that book, All the King's Men, it was hard for me to get through certain pages. I was just kind of overwhelmed by the beauty and sadness of it.
I think every actor that we have talked to on this podcast has had a unique path into his or her profession. I want to talk to you a little bit about the University of North Florida and Othello and what that production meant to you, because from what I've read, it was a very important point in your career, and it kind of reoriented you in a very good direction. Do you recall that show?
I sure do. I was a 33-year-old ex-illustrator who had given up my dream of acting a decade earlier. And I found myself high and dry, bridges burnt in Northeast Florida. And I thought, well, I have to start over. I might as well do what I please. And a guy I was working for at a landscape nursery said, well, I do community theater in Jacksonville. You should come up and audition. And so I did. And I got this part in a Shakespeare play. And I guess I was ready for it, because I took a big bite out of that. And I've been kind of doing that thing ever since.
So you were a theater major at Drake. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you do. Yes.
And you go soon thereafter to New York with stars in your eyes. And what happens?
And it just knocked the wind out of me. This was in the late 70s. It was a kind of a gloomy, rough town, and I was not prepared for it. or I wasn't prepared for showbiz either. So it was all I could do to get a roof over my head and buy groceries and stuff. So I took a retail job and I did that for a long time. And then I eventually found my way into being a magazine illustrator. And I did that for many years.
And were you good at your job? Could you do a good picture? Because I know good magazine illustrating is amazing, but it's probably very labor intensive.
It is labor intensive, therefore hard to make a living at it. But I was good at it. I had always been able to draw pictures, and it must have been natural to me because I just fell back on it. I took some weekend illustration courses and had the nerve to go out and pitch a portfolio. I don't know why I didn't bring that same nerve to the craft of acting. But
some reason you didn't. If I had run into you in a Pottery Barn store, were you a good salesman?
I'm not sure. Well, I was an amiable salesman. I was a Midwesterner, you know. I came from a small town in Iowa, so I was agreeable and helpful, I think. I hope I was. And I made good friends there. You just never know which jobs are going to find where you're going to, in which job you will find your social circle. But that was a lovely job, and I still have dear friends from those days.
And I think the early 90s, you enroll in the Alabama Shakespeare Festival's University of Alabama Master of Fine Arts Professional Actor Training Program. You had already studied theater. You'd done some acting.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that program and what happened there and how that changed your interest in acting.
Well, I'd gone about as far as I could go in Jacksonville, I think. And I had branched out and started traveling around the capitals of the old Confederacy, you know, doing plays in Equity Theaters, Little Rock, Jackson, Montgomery, Atlanta. And I just thought, well, it's time, you know, I thought I had kind of, I thought I was good enough to be a professional. And so I thought, well, what do I do now? Do I go back to New York, which had never been super kind to me? Or I knew a fellow. He's actually brother to my now wife. He had gone to that program at Montgomery at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival. And he had what seemed to me an ideal life. He did classical work 8 months out of the year. And then he had a long break to do what he pleased. And I thought, that sounds good. And you could do it by way of a graduate assistantship, so you didn't accumulate a debt. And that's what I did. I felt like the oldest living grad student at that time, but it was all right. I made good friends there, and I got a good experience.
I came across an interview where there was a copy editor for the Orlando Sentinel who wrote about theater for the Times Union. Her name is Jennifer Greenhill Taylor. And she remembers visiting you on your birthday near the end of your Jacksonville stay. She says you were downcast and despondent. And I'm quoting her now. I then gave him the worst piece of advice I ever gave to anybody. I told him to give up acting and start teaching.
I don't think she really meant it. Okay. I didn't take it that seriously. I knew that was never going to happen.
But soon thereafter,
she was just worried. She was just worried about me.
But soon thereafter, something really fortuitous happens. You meet an amazing playwright named Moises Kaufman. What happens?
Well, I couldn't get arrested when I came back to New York, but I had followed Miss Carrie Preston back here because I met her doing a play in Alabama. So I got myself a retail job, and I thought, all right, here we go once again. But I thought, I'm not going to give my life to New York City. I'll give myself 2 years. If I can't get some kind of part up here, I'll go back down south because I had some success there. And after it was getting pretty close to the two-year deadline when I was introduced to Moises Kaufman, and he had a big stack of papers that had to do with the trials of Oscar Wilde. And he needed grown-up gentlemen who could do an English accent credibly, and I felt I was one. And so I visited him, and I signed on to his project as one of the lawyers in the trial. And when it came time to mount a production, the guy playing Oscar Wilde was fired. And this is like maybe 12 days until we open.
Oh, my goodness.
Moises Kaufman was going to hold auditions. And I said, you know, I'm really happy with the part I have, but I have a couple of ideas about what to do with Oscar Wilde. I wonder if it'd be all right if I audition for you. And he said, sure, that's fine. And somehow I got the part. God help me. And then we did it. And it was successful.
This is a gross indecency. And I think one of the things that happened is Kaufman, according to the story, got a reviewer from the New York Times to come watch and got a good review. And that kind of really changed everything. I don't know quickly, but it certainly was a big event.
Yeah, it changed everyone's life instantly that was associated with the production, because suddenly here we were in a, you know, we were in a senior center hall in the West Village, and suddenly there's the high and mighty of New York City waiting online to get, hoping to get a ticket. It was great. It was heady stuff, I must say. And I'm really glad I did not know that Ben Brantley was in the audience the night he was.
Wow. One of the things that I think happened soon thereafter is you got offered a part to be in the Michael Bay film Armageddon, and you turned it down because you had this great gig. Do I have that story right?
Oh, my God. Your research is beyond thorough. Yes, I had been... I had read for such a part, and I don't even know if it was a part worth having at the time. I think it eventually did become one, but we had just opened Gross Indecency, and I thought, I have worked too hard and too long to have my dream come true on the live stage, and I'm not going to go west and do a disaster movie when and not savor this thing, which I thought was so important and meant so much to me. So, but it did flummox a few industry people, but that's all right. It all worked out.
One of the things that is really remarkable about your career is that even though you're probably best known for doing television right now, you had some amazing early parts in theater that I think a lot of people would covet. You were able to do The Misanthrope off-Broadway with Roger Rees and Uma Thurman. And I think Howard Davies and Kevin Spacey track you down to do The Iceman Cometh. Do you remember that production of The Iceman Cometh?
God, yes. Who could forget it? I mean, you always remember your first Broadway show. It was intense. You know, it was a big, dark, long play. But for some reason, I think I was kind of fearless at that point. And I thought, oh, I can manage this. And I did. And I think it was like our third or fourth preview when I was lying drunk on the stage, which we did before the play started. And I thought, oh, my God, it's Broadway. I forgot to notice that I'm doing a Broadway show before a live audience. So, but it was great. It was a magnificent experience, and it was a damn good show, I think. I mean, how great is it to be in an O'Neill play that gets revived maybe once a generation? And so I was very proud of that.
I wonder if the fact that when you first went to New York, you didn't have success changed your outlook and your tolerance and your whole approach to theater, even if that doesn't seem like the best way to go, that you have this rejection, you kind of give up, and then you come back. Did it change the way that you looked at your work for the better?
Yes, I think so. It changed the way I looked at everything I do, I think. It taught me a couple of lessons. I wasn't happy to learn them at the time, I don't think, but it taught me that it's not a race, for one thing, because if it was about being a star by the time you're 30, I was screwed anyway. But to be patient and to be a little bit kind to yourself and to accept a different path. So I often say to young actors, what if you love this thing, then try to hold on to it if you can. But be mindful that you might not have your break until you're in your middle years or even later, possibly. Could you stand it? Do you like it that well? Do you like the process of it? quite apart from glamour or fame or money or anything like that. So those are the lessons I took away, and I'm glad to have them.
I want to ask you about your creative slash romantic partnership with Kerry Preston and what that has meant as an actor when you are acting not only opposite each other, but talking about roles, rehearsing together. I have no idea how you work together, but what does that mean to the two of you to be in similar professions and to be able to occasionally act opposite one another?
It's great, really, and maybe unusual. I don't know, but I trust her theatrical instincts implicitly, and I think she thinks that I do all right. And we don't talk about it a lot, but when we do, I know it counts. And we stay out of each other's way a lot, except to celebrate jobs or to hammer out whether a job ought to be taken or not, that kind of thing. I know it's tough for some people to be married to someone in the same industry. We've just been lucky. It has worked out for us.
When you get more credits, you obviously have more opportunities, but also your priorities change. And it's not just because the parts you're offered are older as you get older. As you are thinking about the kinds of things that excite you or terrify you or that thrill you, how would you say your taste has evolved? And how do you judge projects now that maybe you didn't judge them 10, 15 years ago?
Gosh, well, 10 or 15 years ago, you know, I tended to like every part.
If there's a check attached, I say yes.
Yeah, of course. I guess everybody just gets a little pickier as they get older. I always look at the words. You know, to me, it's all language. I guess that's just my theater background. But I think the magic in our world is language, or the spoken word, or writing, or verbality, or something. So that's still what I'm looking for. And which is not to say that you couldn't play someone who was mute to good effect. I would welcome a challenge like that too, I think. But I guess I'm drawn more to extremes of character, period, dialect, all of that stuff. I want to be the grizzled old pirate with an eye patch and an accent. These are the things I'm looking for.
Well, I'm going to ask you about a couple parts that you have recently played and how they've evolved. And I want to start with Henry Gale or Benjamin Linus, whatever we want to call your character on Lost, and what you knew when you got into that part and how it changed as seasons progressed.
Well, that part was a guest part when it was offered, and it seemed like a good one. I was a little worried because it was so far from home. It was shot in Hawaii, and we live in New York. But, you know, there was nothing else coming my way. So I thought, well, here we go. And, you know, I'll be back in 3 weeks, and, you know, it'll be fun. And then I ended up being out there for 5 years. But it's kind of a character actor's dream to take, you know, a guest spot, or I don't know. In a way, I think the guest spot part of it was by way of an audition to see if I could be a compelling villain in their narrative. And I evidently passed that audition. They could have just as easily killed me off and gone on to Plan B.
Right.
But I'm glad that I survived it, and it worked out great. It was a character and context that were good for me, and I really enjoyed that part.
One of the things that happens, I think, with a show like that, that was unbelievably popular, and where you're playing a character that's remarkably polarizing, is people in the real world conflate the actor with the part. And I think I stumbled across a story that unfolded at the Honolulu International Airport involving a TSA agent. What happened at the airport?
Oh, you should remind me, because I don't remember a thing at the airport.
Here's what happens. You're being screened for security, and this woman who is a TSA agent is checking you for liquids and gels, and she looks up and says, you, I hate you. You're bad. You're a very bad man.
Well, yeah, I do remember that now, but, you know, she could take a number, because that was, there were a lot of people that had that reaction. People would stop me on the street constantly, even in Honolulu, you know, which was a town that celebrated that show because we were local. But people would cross the street to complain to me about the behavior of my character, as if I were improvising it or writing it or, you know, making those choices on my own.
How do you answer that when somebody doesn't know, or maybe they know, but maybe they forget? And this has happened, I know, a lot with actors on daytime serials. You know, people come up to them and just like start berating them, that they forget that this is a scripted show and that you're playing somebody, not that person.
You know, you don't know whether to be flattered or not, but I think you should be. If people have just, they have watched you and taken you so into themselves that you've crossed that boundary line. You're no longer a performer. It's no longer a fiction. That thing is real, and they have a reaction to it. And without maybe thinking about it too hard, they just express their feelings as if you were the character. And I know in part of their consciousness, they understand that I'm paid to pretend, but it doesn't stop them from having a visceral reaction. It's quite interesting. You know, I played a serial killer once. That my first real TV break was playing a serial killer on The Practice, and the Christmas season after it appeared, I was going up the escalator at Macy's, and a lady on the other side going down started screaming and dropped her shopping bags because she me.
She recognized you and wanted to call the authorities?
I think so. I think she was just stricken. God love her.
When you were doing Arrow and Mozart in the Jungle, playing Caden James on the former and Morton Norton on the latter, what is your relationship yes. with the people who create that show? Because they have written something that they are offering you as an actor. What are the conversations that you have with your showrunners and writers about character, and how quickly does it take you to start standing up for your character in conversations with your writers?
Oh, wow. Those are big after questions. I think my brief on jobs like that is to come in and make something happen, you know, they're hoping that I'm playful enough and focused enough to take a small part and, you know, do something with it, make it juicy or spice up their narrative in some way. And in both of those shows, I think it worked out fairly quickly. It doesn't always work that way, but I was, you know, it's always fun to play the villain because it has more layers. So it's nice to be a full on true villain on Arrow. The opposite is true of Mozart in the Jungle, where I get to, it's like going back to my theater days when I played more comedy than tragedy. And I get to be something flamboyantly silly and broad, and no one's telling me not to. Apparently it's what they want. So I was just doing it, and I kept thinking somebody's going to come at some point and say, you need to dial this back. But quite the contrary was true. They seemed to like where it was going. So that was fun and good for my actor's soul, because I have played, you know, sinister and close for many years now. So it's nice to bust out a little bit.
Do you ever have the perspective that, you know, between Lost and Arrow and Mozart in the Jungle and other shows that you've worked on, that the opportunities for actors to do something that just wouldn't have been a television series even a couple of years ago is remarkable, that there is as good work on television now that there might be in theater and independent film.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think it's trite to say, but I think we're living through a second golden age of television. It wants so much content, and it is so much a writer's medium now that I think a lot of the grown-up work, the grown-up script writing, is happening for TV. And it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of good jobs, and it's a lot of excitement. I'm thrilled to be part of that industry right now.
How do you figure out how you do theater? Because I think the last time you're on Broadway, if I'm not mistaken, was Hedda Gabler. Is that right? Through 2002? Yeah. And yeah. Obviously there's a lot of good theater that's not on Broadway, but you know, TV, especially now, the jobs are good, the money's good. There's not a lot of plays on Broadway. It's mostly musicals. So how do you figure out a balance between, you know, what puts food on the table and some good work, between what you kind of studied in college and was kind of your key to your career not that long ago?
Well, I wish I could say that I had it figured out. I mean, the only thing I know is that a modern day actor needs to be ready to play on all these platforms, I think. If you want to make your living and keep yourself interested, I miss the theater. I wish I did more of it. I'm always saying that, but then I don't do it. So I did a play last winter in New York City, and it was satisfying, but it was hard. It's hard work, and if you get away from it for a while, you forget what 8 shows a week really means to your body and your stamina. So. But I don't feel a great divide between my stage life and my camera life, because to me, I continue to think of it in terms of character work and rehearsal. Rehearsal for TV and film doesn't look like rehearsal for a play, but it's there if you think of all those early takes, all those master shots as, you know, rehearsals. Then by the time you get to your close-up, when you really have to have figured out the character or the speech, you know, you've done it a few times and you've thrown out your worst choices, and it might be something worth looking at.
I know that when, say, a professional athlete, let's just say the Winter Olympics are coming up, you know, an ice skater is preparing for his or her Olympics. He or she is training with a coach, you know, 4 or 5 hours a day, even though they've been skating their entire lives. What is the equivalent for an actor? How do you stay sharp and make sure that you don't lose your edge, so to speak, even though you are well-trained and have gone through the training that a lot of other actors maybe haven't?
Well, that's $1 million question, really. I think it is, because I say guiltily that I haven't done class work or workshop work in a long time. Because I'm at it so many days as it is, I just try to make each day a problem-solving day, you know, to be in a way my own teacher, or at least to ask the questions that a teacher might ask. And I try to mix things up a bit. I try every chance I get to go do a workshop or a table read of a restoration comedy or something like that, that is more flamboyantly linguistic than maybe the work I do day to day, just to keep me feeling like a stage actor.
Let me ask you this last question. Given that there were some moments in your career where it looked like maybe it wasn't all going to happen, besides yourself, who encouraged you? Was there a person or people who said, stick with it? I know it looks grim. I know it's hard, but this is something you need to keep pursuing and not quit.
There are so many people along the way, you know. I remember when I took my weekend illustration course at the Parsons School, I had a teacher. I went to her and boldly stated that I was going to go out and do that for a living, And instead of saying, "Are you crazy?" she said, "Yeah, yeah, I think you are ready." She was German. "I think you are ready." And it worked out, actually. And I've had good teachers along the way and coworkers. You know, I took a couple of classes at the HB studio in New York, and my instructor for Shakespeare and scene study was an old stage manager named Aaron Frankel. And he showed me that it was what you put out past the foot that counted. He kind of broke me of the idea of, you know, this was an inward process. He made it all outward, and I'll always be grateful to him for that.
Michael Emerson, thank you for coming on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Wow, this was great. Thank you.
Have a great evening, and I appreciate your time, and good luck with everything you got going.
Thanks so much.
Take care. That was Michael Emerson on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. And if you like what you heard, you can check out past episodes. And while you're enjoying more from Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or at podcastone.com. And don't forget to rate, review, and share. I'm John Horn. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Download new episodes every Wednesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or subscribe at iTunes.